Maryland Shipping Corp versus United States, number 20-2269. We're happy to have counsel. We wish we could see you in the courtroom, but we're happy to be doing this via Zoom. Same rules apply to a Zoom conference, 15 minutes per side. We'll give appellant's counsel the opportunity to reserve some time for rebuttal. And so without further ado, I'll be keeping time. I suggest you do so too, just so you can pace yourself and be sure you get in what you want to get in. Appellant's counsel, Mr. Chalos, will you be reserving any time?
Yes, Your Honor. If it pleases the court, may I reserve 3 minutes?
That is granted. Okay, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm George Chalos, and I appear for the appellant, Netherland Shipping Corporation. The parties come today to present a question of first impression, but happily for all of us, it's not a difficult question. Indeed, the case law and the undisputed facts make clear that the district court made a mistake. I think I heard the court in an earlier argument use the expression, the district court shanked it. Well, Judge Andrew shanked it here in finding that the district court lacked subject matter jurisdiction. It did, and it does. And that's because the claims presented to the district court fall squarely within the district court's maritime and admiralty jurisdiction. Here, we're asking that the decision be reversed and the matter remanded to proceed on the merits.
We understand the positions. We've been involved with the case, not as deeply as you folks have, but would you speak to us for just a moment here about the two separate claims that are being made, right? There's a statutory cause of action in play as well as the contractual one. So the statutory cause of action.
Yes.
The government's argument, as I understand it, is that your section 1904H claim isn't cognizable as an independent cause of action. And it doesn't waive sovereign immunity. And therefore it has to be brought in the Court of Federal Claims. What are you relying on in the statute to say there's a clear waiver of sovereign immunity?
Right. So I take the position, Your Honor, that the statute, we've argued to the district court that section 1910, which gives a citizen suit provision that allows you to proceed before the district court, is the statutory authority for the position. But I go one step before that, saying that the Congress has already waived the government's sovereign immunity because the nature and the substance of this claim is salty in flavor. It falls within the court's maritime and admiralty jurisdiction because it's the delay of a vessel in navigation.
Well, that's pulling the statutory claim into the other claim, right? I mean, are you saying anytime there's that kind of a claim, that's an independent basis for jurisdiction? It doesn't matter what the statute says?
Yes, correct. And I'll cite to the ASTA engineering case in the Court of Claims from 2000, just a couple of nuggets that the court wrote, that the jurisdiction of the district courts over actions involving maritime contracts exists at the expense of the jurisdictional grants of the Tucker Act. The government says, well, you have to read this statutory claim in conjunction with the Tucker Act. And we say, no, you have to read this statutory claim in conjunction with the court's constitutional grant, its original jurisdiction, with the Suits and Admiralty Act, with 28 USC 1333, and the fact that at no time after the enactment of the Suits and Admiralty Act has Congress expressly conferred admiralty jurisdiction on the U.S. Court of Federal Claims for its predecessors, which exercised Tucker Act jurisdiction. Congress waived sovereign immunity with respect to maritime matters. so that the U.S. could be sued in the district courts. So there is some overlap on the jurisdictional hook for both claims. But what we say is that the government in the district court jumped over the constitutional grant to the district court's subject matter jurisdiction, ignored it, and then went to the Tucker Act.
You'd have to, well, in your brief, you seem to argue that the parties could, and you cite the settlement agreement as a basis for jurisdiction. But if there's not jurisdiction, it wouldn't matter what you and the government said on a piece of paper, would it?
It does, Your Honor. And I wanted to step back one second. It's not a settlement agreement. It's a negotiated contract between the parties.
Call it what you want. It's a negotiated document between you and the United States. Isn't it a fundamental fact that parties can't confer jurisdiction on the federal court? It doesn't matter whether you and the other side say, yeah, we want this in federal court. If there's not jurisdiction, there's not jurisdiction. If there is, there is. And that stands independent of anything that the two of you happen to say in an agreement, right?
I think that's correct, but I'd like to explain one problem if you stop the analysis of, well, you can't confer jurisdiction, there's no jurisdiction, so therefore go to the court of claims. The government's told the district court, and you can find it in the appellate record at page 107, Judge Andrews asked the assistant U.S. attorney, well, Ms. Hughes, is it your position then that the breach of contract claim cannot be brought anywhere, Your Honor? And the assistant U.S. attorney said, that is correct, Your Honor. Judge Andrews' response was, okay, I appreciate a straight answer there. So what I'm saying to the court here is that makes no sense. You can't have an agreement, a negotiated resolution that's memorializing the party's rights and obligations, right? Provide in the contract some language that says, well, if there's a dispute, you're going to go to the district court of the District of Delaware. And if you're bringing the breach of contract claim, you bear the burden of proof. But when you actually try to exercise that right, we're going to tell you you have to go to a court. And then when we get there, we'll say we never waive sovereign immunity and your claim goes into a black hole. In fact, it's an empty right.
All that may be true. Yeah. My question to you is, and I hear you saying yes, if there's not the question of jurisdiction doesn't depend on what you and a government lawyer agreed to, right? It can't depend on that, right?
I agree with that statement, Your Honor, but at that statement in and of itself, maybe it is an incorrect way to frame the issues that are before the court now, because it's not a matter, we're not basing our argument on what the terms of the agreement say. And in part, we raise that argument to support that this is where the parties intended to be, because that's where they're supposed to be, if that makes sense. I mean, there should be no dispute that a contract relating to the operation of the ship, the employment of its seafarers, the maintenance of the seafarers is salty in flavor. There's no dispute, the government doesn't dispute about the constitutional grant of admiralty jurisdiction to the district court. What they're now saying, after, by the way, litigating one of these cases through appeal in the District of D.C., right, is that, well, you know what, maybe we should have raised the subject matter jurisdiction argument there. So we'll try it here. I mean, a court's already heard one of these disputes. The court satisfied itself in the District of D.C. that it had subject matter jurisdiction, rendered a decision that went on appeal to the circuit court. So I think to limit the inquiry to, well, you can't agree and confer jurisdiction by agreement, I agree with that, but that's not what happened here.
Do you want to speak to the Fourth Circuit's Angelics opinion and how that affects your case?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The Angel X was
okay, Angel X, thanks. Yeah.
So the government got a black eye in the district court in the Eastern District of Virginia by Judge Dumas. He had some very scathing language about how the Coast Guard's actions were the worst, most egregious abuse of discretionary authority he's ever seen in 30 years as a federal judge. The government took an emergency appeal. We traipsed out to Lewisburg, West Virginia, when the Fourth Circuit judges were having their conference. We went to a historic courthouse that had spittoons at the end of the aisles. It was pretty neat, actually. And a heavy hitter from Washington came in and said, this is something that's really important to the national security and to the national interest. And by the way, the Coast Guard has the authority, unreviewable discretionary authority, to hold up a ship, and not the court. The court can't tell you the terms to let the ship go. The Angel X Fourth Circuit decision said, that's right, you have an after the fact remedy where you can bring a claim for unreasonable delay.
Right, so holding. Why should we not follow that?
Well, we should follow it, and we should let it go
forward. No. As I understood the Fourth Circuit's decision, well, I'm sorry, not the Fourth Circuit's. I got my Angel X's backwards. Yeah. The DC Circuit's Angel X. Got two Angel X's going on.
Yes,
here.
Correct. It's all the same case.
The DC Circuit, they ruled in a way that's contrary to your interests, right?
No, Your Honor, actually it's not. So that was a subject, that was not a subject matter jurisdiction dispute. That was a dispute saying it was a summary judgment that because the parties had agreed certain terms, because there was no evidence in the record of actual damages, there was no claim presented that was going to go beyond a summary judgment standard. Again,
the government says, hey, don't pay attention to drive-by jurisdictional rulings. And I hear you saying something not that different, which is that case just doesn't really matter. Is that it?
Well, I think that's correct, Your Honor. One important point to bear in mind, Angel X isn't factually analogous because the whole issue in that case was that there wasn't an agreement. There wasn't a contract between the parties, right? There was no agreement that could possibly be agreed. And so the challenge to Judge Dumas was about—
Are we back to whether you can agree on jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that. I'm saying the nature and the substance of the contract at issue here, it is salty. It gives rise to a maritime claim.
Okay.
The 1904H claim for the delay of a vessel in navigation. There's been plenty of cases that talk about,
counsel. I want to ask you about, since Judge Jordan brought it, mentioned it, the Fourth Circuit decision.
Yes.
And I guess the operative holding in that case was that withholding of clearance under Section 1908E was not maritime. Now, I guess you say that, and it's true that there was no agreement in the Angel X case, but do you dispute that withholding clearance under Section 1908E is not maritime?
Yes, Your Honor, I do, because that's not quite a full understanding of the issue. The Fourth Circuit looked at whether or not the supplemental admiralty rules gave us as petitioners the right, the absolute right to post a bond for the release of the vessel. And what the Fourth Circuit said was, no, this isn't a civil arrest under Rule C, and it's not a civil attachment under Rule B, so therefore you don't get the benefit of the corollary rule in Rule E. This is an enforcement action by the Coast Guard, and they don't have to let the ship go. It stops way short of the question of, now you go to the next step, you do a negotiation, you come to a contract. Now here, this court's different because this court needs to look at the nature of the contract, right? And again, I say the contract is maritime. I say that the withholding of a vessel's departure clearance is maritime. And I point the court to the Supreme Court case.
Well, hold on. Let me put this another way. I mean, so is withholding of clearance not maritime?
No, it is maritime. In fact, there's nothing more maritime. It's the Coast Guard that has the ability.
So let me just follow up then. Is all of the APPS maritime?
Absolutely. The Act Prevent Pollution from Ships talks about the regulation of vessels in navigation and whether or not they are operating in violation of those regulations while in U.S. waters.
So is the Fourth Circuit just wrong?
I don't think that the Fourth Circuit addressed this issue, and the issue that it addressed was slightly off kilter. It was whether or not the claim that the government wrongly withheld the vessel and didn't give us reasonable terms falls in the district court's maritime jurisdiction. And the Fourth Circuit relied on a case called Speed Mining, and they say this is a discretionary function given to the Coast Guard, an expert agency in these matters, and there's no law or standard which the district court can review it. So it's a very complicated administrative ruling, but it doesn't bear on the issues in this case.
You're a bad out of time. Judge Jordan, do you have any other questions?
If you let me, no, I just ahead, want to pursue ahead. This Angel X thing for sure. Just another moment.
Absolutely.
Here's the language from Angel X, Fourth Circuit Angel X. It quotes 1904H, then turns to admiralty jurisdiction and says, after noting that an in rem suit obviously is going to have admiralty jurisdiction, it says, appellees unreasonably stretch the law to classify this matter as an in rem action. And then, as Judge Chigueras was noting, they say that section 1908E, which has to do with this withholding of the departure opportunity, is not something that's governed by admiralty, right? So
no, that's why, not right.
What is it the fact that they were talking about in rem versus not in rem? Is that the difference here? How is it you're distinguishing and saying, forget what the Fourth Circuit said?
Yeah, that's an easy one, Judge. So the arguments in the district court and the Fourth Circuit were based on the following, that the Coast Guard's withholding of the vessel's departure clearance was a functional arrest or attachment of the vessel. So we were arguing that under the supplemental admiralty rules, that we have the absolute right to post a bond, let the ship go, and the government doesn't get the ability to ask for more than just a bond. And there was arguments and citations.
Yeah, yeah. So is your assertion here, we're different because we never said that this was an arrest and this is in rem? Is that the basis on which you're distinguishing the case?
No, I mean, in part, I think that is a correct statement, but that's not the basis of the argument. What we're saying here is that the Fourth Circuit never looked at the question of whether or not the withholding of a vessel's departure clearance it gives rise to the district court's admiralty jurisdiction when you go and assert your later after the fact remedy, which the Fourth Circuit says is available.
Yeah. So just so that I'm clear.
Yeah.
You're saying the Fourth Circuit narrowly looked at whether something was an arrest and therefore in rem, independent of whether something is arrest and in rem. We're saying this contract sounds in admiralty, sounds in maritime jurisdiction of the court. And that's why the Fourth Circuit is not different, or have I misunderstood what you're saying?
No, I think that's right, Your Honor. And I'll just make one point on this. The Fourth Circuit made a point of saying that the Coast Guard exercising the ability to withhold the departure clearance is an enforcement action, not a supplemental rule B or C arrest or attachment. That was the distinction that they were making. Not that it wasn't an admiralty matter, that it wasn't the way it was being argued by the parties at that time in that court.
I got you, thanks.
I hope that's clear.
Judge Sirica, do you have anything?
No.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll get you on rebuttal and we'll hear from your adversary.
May it please the court, Anne Murphy for the United States. Your Honor, the district court was entirely correct that it had no jurisdiction over either the contract claim or the claim for statutory damages. And just to get to this point about whether the APS is maritime, the question is whether the district court has jurisdiction over it. And the district court's jurisdiction is over civil cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, if we're talking about admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. So I think it's a mistake to think of, as Mr. Chella suggested, that an entire statute can be salty. I understand that this salty image...
Without worrying whether an entire statute is salty or not, let's talk about whether this case is salty. Here, right. You have an agreement, and in that agreement, representatives of the United States say things like, the United States agrees that the criminal and civil penalty claims of the United States against the vessel in rem shall attach the vessel's release security as provided pursuant to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, Admiralty Maritime Claims, Supplemental Rule E5. isn't that a direct statement by the United States government through an authorized representative, a Coast Guard officer, that this is a maritime case? This is an admiralty case. It's properly viewed as an admiralty case. It's governed by the maritime and admiralty supplemental rules to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure.
No, not at all, Your Honor. And there's several reasons.
Then what is it? What does it mean for the United States to sign a document that says this is going to be the release of security is provided pursuant to those specific admiralty and maritime rules?
So what happened? So first of all, I'd just like to explain that this was raised in counsel's reply brief. So we didn't have an opportunity to actually address this in our briefing. So I may give you a slightly more fulsome reason. There is a principle that if there is a maritime claim against a ship, and then the parties substitute money for the ship, that when the vessel goes and the money attaches to the ship, that the claim remains maritime, that it keeps its maritime claim. And I think that's counsel's argument in this case. Here.
I think so too.
Right, exactly. So, but that claim doesn't arise because there is no maritime claim against the vessel in this case, Your Honor. The claim is a claim to pay a criminal penalty. If you look at page 55 of the joint appendix, you'll see the actual bond in the case.
This says, I'm reading from your document that criminal and civil penalty claims. It was understood by the federal government when it wrote this. And I'm pretty sure that Mr. Chalice's client didn't say, here, you signed this, government, because we've got the whip hand in this matter.
This was
presented by the government, right? The government drafted it. The government presented it and said, we agree that criminal and civil penalties are going to be handled pursuant to the admiralty and maritime rules of civil procedure.
I understand. We own it. It says in REM, in the context of this case, that does not refer necessarily to a claim that would sound in maritime. And here's why. As I say, there's no actual maritime claim against the vessel. The only way that the claim against a vessel in REM would arise in an app situation is if, you know, the owner doesn't pay a criminal penalty and the United States would actually go after the vessel.
Yeah, but what regardless of whether it's in REM or not.
That's the admiralty though.
Well, are you saying that if there's not a specific in REM claim, there's never admiralty jurisdiction? Isn't admiralty and maritime jurisdiction based in just what the United States Supreme Court said in Kirby, the protection of maritime commerce?
Exactly, Your Honor. It's about maritime commerce. And this really has, this is a criminal, what this contract is doing is it's like providing for a criminal penalty and for the prosecution of a crime. So my second answer to your question is that even if in paragraph 9, the government was recognizing some admiralty flavor, and we're really not, the principle that the admiralty claim attaches to the money and makes the claim against the money admiralty just doesn't apply here, because the claim that was going to attach to the ship is not a maritime claim. So
the government's position is, it could have held that ship for 10 years and that wouldn't affect maritime commerce. And under Kirby, it wouldn't matter. You can hold a ship and you can refuse to let it out of port for as long as you feel like it. As long as what you're saying is, we're talking criminal law here, it's got nothing to do with maritime commerce.
No, Your Honor, that is emphatically not our position.
Well, then what is your position?
So our position is, the question is not whether the overall transaction affects maritime commerce. It's not whether from the perspective of the vessel, this affects maritime commerce. Kirby is absolutely clear. What matters is whether the contract and the terms and the provisions of the contract, whether the principal objective is maritime commerce.
Okay.
And so we have a lot of maritime contracts referred to in this case. They involve things like the carriage of goods, the carriage of passengers, marine insurance, necessaries for ships, cargo. Well,
just pay attention to this contract. Let's look at this agreement.
Okay, so this contract, Your Honor, this contract, if you read the entire contract, it provides for jurisdiction over the criminal case. It provides for the care and housing of criminal witnesses and defendants in the United States, in hotels, eating United States food. It provides that the evidence in the criminal case is authentic, and it provides a bond for a criminal penalty. And at no point does any provision in Kirby's language make reference to maritime transactions or services, because really? This isn't even a commercial contract, Your Honor.
The statement that the United States agrees that all criminal penalties claims of the United States as against the vessel as provided will be handled as provided according to the maritime claims rules of the civil of the supplemental rules for civil procedure. That's not in the United States view, that's just got nothing to do with whether this is a maritime contract.
Let's assume for the point of argument, let's assume that that provision, clause 9, the in rem claim against the vessel, let's say that is completely maritime, which I disagree with. But if that were true, there's another part of Kirby that's relevant here, which is that, you know, if there is an insubstantial part of the contract which is not maritime, then it doesn't matter. It can still be a maritime contract, and vice versa.
Is it insubstantial that the whole motion of this agreement was to get the ship out of port? The whole point of this was, look, we'll say whatever you want. Just let us go. Right?
That seems to be
what was going on here. We got your ship and you're not going anywhere. Look, give us the document. We'll sign it. We'll pay the money. We'll put the money up. Just let the ship go. You're saying that which infuses the case has really nothing to do with maritime commerce.
It's not whether the agreement between the parties or what. You're looking at it from the perspective exclusively of the vessel. The vessel says, I want to go, they've got me, I want to engage in commerce. If you read our brief, Your Honor, we're like, we don't care what you do. It's like, we just want to exercise our sovereign interest and prosecute this crime. This is not a commercial contract. This is a contract between the sovereign and a criminal defendant. It does not have reference to maritime services or transactions. If you look at the actual contract, and I really urge you to look at the contract itself and what it provides and the obligations on the parties, it says nothing about what the vessel's going to do after. The vessel could bob around in the Delaware Bay forever. It could be sunk and be a habitat for reef fish. It's like, as far as the contract is concerned, it doesn't matter. What the contract provides is that the criminal action is going to be prosecuted. And the Fourth Circuit decision in Angelix is important. The actual withholding of the departure clearance is not an in rem action against the vessel. That doesn't create our maritime.
Okay, assume that's true. And assume this isn't an in rem action. Does Fourth Circuit's Angel X speak to the point that your opponent is making at all? If all that the Fourth Circuit said in Angel X is, quote, appellee's unreasonably stretched law to classify this matter as an in rem action, and everybody here agrees that this is not an in rem action, does Angel X speak to this case at all?
Well, I don't think I don't think Mr. Chalos is necessarily going to agree. I don't want to speak to him. He's right there. But it's the in rem and the admiralty rules that would make this maritime. And one of the reasons that it's not, that there's no maritime claim against this vessel at all. The criminal penalty isn't maritime. The withholding of the departure clearance isn't maritime. And so that's why when you take the claims and you attach them to the money, that's not an admiralty claim. Obviously, the government's trying to wrap up all of its potential possible liability and fill in everything, But that, in fact, what paragraph 9 is saying, we have the money, we're going to take any claims that we could have had against the vessel in rem, because the APS allows for that, so that just in case we have someone who won't agree, we can actually go after the ship.
So what was the purpose of agreeing that you would be handling your disputes in the District of Delaware? Any dispute between the United States and owner operator regarding payment shall be submitted to the United States District Court for the District of Delaware. Now, everybody agrees you can't confer jurisdiction where it doesn't exist, but isn't that evidence? Doesn't that reflect an understanding about the law on the part of the United States?
Not at all, Your Honor, because
it's just ignorance in drafting?
A little bit of a head scratcher, counsel.
No. So that provision comes up in the first part of the agreement, which has to do with the terms, like if there's a violation, how the bond's going to be paid out. In that provision, Your Honor, Netherlands doing the paying and we are doing the suing if there's a breach. So it's going to be a claim United States.
So your position is, if we have a claim, we can bring it in Delaware. If you have a claim, you got to go to the Court of Claims. That's the way your contract works?
That's the way it is. No. Okay. Your Honor,
I know, I got you. I got your position.
Under 28 USC 1345, there is federal court jurisdiction when the United States brings a claim. So we can bring this claim.
I got you.
When you have a monetary claim against the government, a lot of different rules apply. And this is exactly it. There is jurisdiction.
So, no, I got you. Any dispute doesn't mean any dispute. It means any dispute that we bring against you. That's how you read that document.
Well, any dispute under that paragraph that involves money, right, is any dispute under that paragraph that involves money is going to be, and it only applies to that paragraph, is going to be U.S. versus Netherlands. And for the other ones, if the thing with this case, Your Honor, is that it's a monetary claim. And it's the claims for money against the United States that are controlled by the Tucker Act. So, I think one of the possible reasons that learned counsel failed to spot the jurisdictional issue in Angelix 1 is that case started out with like an APA claim agglomerated onto the claim. So anyway, but that's beside the point. The fact is that it's asymmetrical when you're trying to sue the United States for money damages. And in this case, the contract has no maritime elements. The district court was entirely correct about that. It's not a commercial contract. It has nothing to do with goods or passengers or ships or marine insurance.
It has nothing to do with ships.
Not the ship as such. Okay. So to go back to, it's like Kirby's about, I mean, there's so many maritime contracts in this case, and none of them looks even remotely like this. I mean, they're all about marine insurance, or there's even like a prize case. It's like, this is an entirely different animal, and its terms and provisions and the obligations of the parties relate to the prosecution. The ship is there as a criminal defendant. It's not there because it's selling bananas to the United States. And that makes all the difference. It's just a regular criminal case. I'd just like to respond to the point that you were discussing with Mr. Chalos about section 1904. And that is, it's true that the missing part of the 1904 claim, oh, I'm sorry, I say I'm out of time.
Well, go ahead, I'm interested in what you're saying.
Yeah, the missing part of the 1904H claim, Your Honor, is the waiver of sovereign immunity. I don't believe it's for the similar reasons as to the contract claims, it's not maritime anyway, but even if it were, there would be no immunity waiver for that claim. And so that's why the Tucker Act waiver provides both a court with competent jurisdiction, and it waives the immunity from the government's damage suit for damages against the government.
Thank you, counsel. Judge Jordan, do you have anything more?
No.
And Judge Sirica? Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll hear from your adversary.
Yes, Your Honor, I have four brief points I'd like to make. I'll do my best to speak quickly to get them all in. As a fun note, when Ms. Murphy talks about learned counsel from Angel X, I believe she was my opponent in that case. So we have a lot of history, and she's a very good lawyer. But the court, my first point here is the court, if this court looks at what Judge Andrews wrote at the appendix at page 39, the appendix at page 9, he writes that the principal objective of the contract is to get the ship moving. He writes the principal objective of the agreement is to permit the ship's departure clearance, right? How is that not in the protection of maritime commerce? If you look to the Kirby case and you look to the cases that have interpreted the one I cite to his flame, it talks about a contract that relates to a ship in its use or commerce or navigation on navigable waters or transportation by sea or maritime employment is subject to maritime law, and the case is one of admiralty jurisdiction. This falls squarely in there. Now, just because the government gets the benefit of being able to prosecute a case and have witnesses who, by the way, are seafarers that the agreement itself requires us to continue to employ under a seafarer's contract, it's not a binary choice. It could be a maritime contract that gives some benefit to the government.
Would you speak to Ms. Murphy's assertion that this is distinct and different from any kind of maritime case because it's a criminal prosecution? That makes it qualitatively different. It's not about maritime. It's about a criminal lawbreaker being held to account. And if you've got a claim under Section 1904H, that is something you can take to the Court of Claims.
Well, look, I can't believe the government's advancing that argument without in a straight face.
Well, believe it because she did it. So what's the answer to it?
Well, I understand. Well, if you look at the government's own resource material, and we cited it in our brief, it's the U.S. Coast Guard Marine Safety Manual. At section I.1.A, U.S. government agencies, the first line says U.S. maritime law enforcement efforts involve many different agencies, blah, blah, blah. Maritime law enforcement efforts. That's what this case is about. Section I.1.A.1 talks about the customs holds on the vessels. It says the customs service will normally withhold or deny clearance based upon a request from the Coast Guard in order to ensure vessel compliance with shipping laws and international conventions. MARPOL's international convention, it's intended to protect the marine environment, but balance that ambition with a guarantee that you don't unduly delay vessels. The APS, which is the legislation, the domestic legislation that implements the treaty, it's not self-executing, has right. The same safeguard that you can't unduly delay a vessel. The Fourth Circuit tells us, yeah, if they do, you can go under 1904H and get your damages, right? If you show that it was unreasonable delay. Now, the court asked some questions about the bond and the language about Rule E. That's not by mistake. And I think it's important, if the court will allow me just a few seconds, right? The reason why the government attaches the bond as if it's the vessel, because if it was just, to answer the question about if it's just a criminal case, if it was just a criminal case and the government gets a judgment, they're a judgment creditor, right? But in the maritime world, vessels are subject to lots of lien claims. First preferred mortgages, seafarer wages, personal injury claims, net provision of necessaries, all that would prime just a general judgment credit. So the government is playing this thing like pretty fast and loose. They want the benefit of the maritime rules. They want the benefit of the admiralty protection of a lien claimant, but they don't really want to say that because it would give up the ghost and we'd be having a fight about the unreasonable 36 day delay of the vessel in Delaware, which, by the way, gives rise to damages, all of which are salty. Cargo claims, charter party claims, claims for port expenses, seafarer wages, providing for the maintenance of the seafarers, getting provisions to feed these guys, to bring in replacement crews, to put crew ashore, continuing to employ them, continuing to insure them. Right? These are all maritime claims. Now,
Counsel, you're over time by now, but if you wanted a couple of more seconds, if there's something you didn't get in, I suppose we'll hear you.
No, Your Honor. I mean, this is a 12-page document that the government gives it to you on a take it or leave it basis, right? If they have the greater bargaining power, they know what they're writing. If there's any ambiguity, it's got to go against them. And by the way, on like 9 or 10 of those 12 pages, they're all admiralty obligations. They're all maritime obligations. Release of the ship, the security standing in place of the ship, the control of the seafarers, the provision for the seafarers, the insurance, the maintenance, the employment, et cetera, so forth. This could not be more salty.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Judge Jordan, do you have anything more? And Judge Sirica, anything more? Okay, thank you. Well, we thank counsel for their excellent arguments and briefing. We'll take the case under advisement.